What's going on, guys? This is Chris over at DCCX Exceptional E-Commerce Podcast. I got my boy Aaron Spivak on, founder, co-founder of Hush.
What's up, man? Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on, dude. So we've known each other for, I'd say, almost 2 years now. Was it Forbes 30 Under 30? We got linked that year.
Yeah,
we both grinding at the same time. Talk to me a little bit for people who don't know what Hush is. I know you're a Canada boy. What's Hush?
Yeah, that's a good question. We are Canadian, which is like only weird for Americans. But everyone's like, wait, there's a country up there. There's a market. But yeah, I mean, Hush, we started in 2018. And we started out of a simple hole in the market where we realized that there was such a massive demand for a weighted blanket. And there were definitely some sellers, but they were just like these awful bean bags that sounded like rain sticks. They're impossible to wash, like filled with like plastic gasoline pellets. And nobody was innovating in a space that I'd love to be in, is a space of iteration. So instead of trying to reinvent the mold, I would just be like, how can I make things better? So that's when we created the Hush, which is a premium weighted blanket, one that fits your bed, that washes easy, that stays cool, it's temperature regulating, and we launched in 2018. It's been a cool 4 years, and we've grown it from a zero business to 600K in our first year of sales to almost a $40 million business 4 years later.
Insane. That's crazy, dude. And so how did it get started, right? So was it, you're looking for a weighted blanket on Google one night and you guys had the idea for, or take me through that, right? For us, I wrote down four-way volleyball on a piece of paper. I was selling Chinese knockoff jerseys on eBay, getting my account banned every night from the NHL. And I thought, hey, let me type in volleyball supplier on Alibaba. And that's kind of how we manufactured. Obviously, you don't want to tell too many trade secrets, but how did that process go? How is it different these days? How did you get that first weighted blanket to even like come into Canada?
We were pretty savvy, like with just like looking at like internet trends and stuff like that. And we noticed that there was like hundreds of thousands of searches for weighted blankets. And there was this guy out in the US actually who started a company called Gravity, and it had like a record breaking Kickstarter. It did like almost $10 million in Kickstarter and was like on CNN. It was like probably one of the best Kickstarter campaigns of all time for that product cost, but that's something like a $10,000 bike. And I bought it. I was like, I'm not going to start a company. This is an incredible product. This is an incredible brand. I love everything about it. I just bought one for myself, and then I got it. And it was really at that moment when I got that, and I got every other one that was on Amazon or on Google. And I'm like, oh my God, this product sucks. Like, it is so, this is a scam, right? Like, this is so bad. I can't wash it. It doesn't cover my toes. Like, it makes like a loud, like those rain sticks sound like a whole rain stick when I turn in my bed. Like, yeah, I was sweating. It was just so bad. And I'm like, oh my God, there's so many people that want a product that actually works. The pain is I can't sleep, but the solution was not what was being offered on the market. So
rain sticks,
So we're like, can we make one that actually solves it? Or maybe everyone's making it this way because you just can't make it any other way. And then we reached out to local suppliers in Toronto trying to make a prototype. We reached out to people on Alibaba or on Facebook groups, just like really trying to get our hands on who can make us one that works. And then we got linked up with this sourcer, I guess. I forget his name. He like sources manufacturers. And we kind of listed, hey, this is what it needs to do. And then that's when we started getting into fabric samples and finally got to like where we thought we were happy, and then launched with that product. And obviously since then, we've launched like four or five variations, like getting better and better as we go.
That's awesome. And that sourcing guy, so I hear a lot of horror stories about, I'm paying a sourcing guy and he's taking $5 off the top of my COGS, right? Like, are you still working with that person? Any bad lessons there?
We actually didn't even use that guy, actually, at the end of the day. We were pretty savvy. One of the samples, the manufacturer's name was on the label, the shipping label.
Oh, perfect.
I was like, oh man, I'm going to call that number. So I called it and right away saved 20%, like right off the top. That's amazing. And then that manufacturer actually connected me to another manufacturer that can do the different type of fabric, because we wanted a a mix between spandex and bamboo. And then he connected me to a glass guy because we wanted to go glass bead instead of plastic bead. And then that's kind of where we started meeting different manufacturers in China and Taiwan. And you start to really get to where you are infiltrated in this whole like manufacturing space. But I wouldn't use unless I'm really, there's a lot of situations where you would use a sourcing agent. A, if you're literally inventing something and you need something like a mold done or something from scratch, then you would need someone who's willing to put their neck on the line, because most manufacturers aren't going to, unless you're really like, unless you have a tremendous amount of demand. So like in our case, when we were doing our Kickstarter, which was our special fabric, which is our iced fabric, we went back to that sourcer and say, hey, do you know anyone who can mix bamboo and spandex? And he's like, oh, I think I have a guy. And then we went to that same process on the label, meshes them ourselves.
Awesome. It's crazy how many people start a company, just assume the cogs are what they are without negotiating, without paying fees on sources. Like half the business should be trying to eliminate your cog cost and negotiating your terms, right? Like, I don't know for you guys, but for us, we went from paying 100% down before they'd even start working on it to now most of our suppliers were paying 0% or maybe 10% for them to start. Like, we just got Sam's Club, which is like a 20,000 unit order. And they're going to start that process for 10% down. Like, there's so much more, like, as much as we'll talk about marketing and all that, like, running your business should start at the suppliers. And a lot of people just forget about that.
Yeah. And for majority, you're producing a generic product. It's very rare that you are doing something that's, you're the only person in the world producing it. So being able to negotiate is always in your court, because they're producing anyways, whether they slap your label or do your little variation or your little twist on things. So for us, yeah, like if I look back at what we were paying when we started to what we're paying now, it's game changing. It's completely, I wouldn't slap my old self in the face saying, I can't believe you would do this, right? And the supplier always tells you that you're getting the best deal. You know, oh, there's no profit left. There's never anything left, but like, how is it 50% less than it was like 2 years ago? So it's yin and yang, right? It's, you got to give up to get. We're at a point where we can't really push on price anymore because costs have gone up for everybody worldwide. But can you push on some better terms, right? Exactly. And cash flow is tough when you're starting. So terms are everything.
100%. What about, so we've had some good conversations like offline about your whole take is I want to dominate Canada. What's your perspective now, like 4 or 5 years later? You still want to conquer the U.S. market as well? Is there international growth? For people who start out, should they just stay on their home court, or how do you think about it?
I think it depends. Like, now we're at a point in Canada where when people say weighted blanket, they think of Hush. They don't even say weighted blanket. They say Hush blanket. We've done a tremendous amount of activations. We're on like Dragon's Den, which is like Canadian Shark Tank. We sponsored the Montreal Canadiens when they went all the way to the finals last year. So we did a lot of things. We're on billboards all over the major cities. So we're more known in Canada. And I always believe that like if you try to shoot for everyone, you end up hitting nobody, as opposed to like just really being a sniper. So when we were doing that with Canada, but like even when we look at the US, instead of just like marketing in the US and like seeing what hits, which can be extremely expensive because it's like literally 10 Canadas, we're being more strategic and saying, okay, where do we want to start in the US? Right. And what state, you know, what area of that state, if it's California is big, right? Where in California do we want to start? And then kind of scale from there, because otherwise, unless you've got a tremendous amount of budget, you end up wasting a lot of budget. Like we know for a fact our cooling product does really well in Miami, right? Where you're at in Florida. We know it does well. So why try and sell it in New York in the winter? Right, it doesn't make any sense. So being more targeted in the US, but I always find that people make crossing borders sound easier than it actually is.
That's a good point, man. And that was a learning lesson we did this year was right now we have a whole warehouse in Canada, right? But it is freezing in Canada. Why would people care? Why would people care about CrossNet, right? And normally like the founder and me, I want to see revenue in my Shopify daily in Canada in February. And that's a pretty bad way to look at things. Rather than wasting my budget, having 4 or 5x what my normal, like my acquisition cost is, save those sales, get those sales in the summer or the springtime where they're much more affordable, and go focus on the United States market or the Australian market that's working really well for us. So kind of knowing when and where to spend that money and don't force stuff just for the gratitude of being able to say, hey, I'm selling in this market successfully when you're really not.
Yeah, you can't I do believe in creating demand, but there's no point in creating demand in an area, in a climate or in an area that you know is not going to be supporting you right now. Like, we know that it's a little bit tougher for us to sell blankets, even if they're cooling blankets, when it's 35 degrees outside, right? Because people want to be outside. So we pick and choose our spots. And we learned that the hard way for sure, I think, in 2021. Or mostly because 2020 was a fake year because people were inside the whole year. So we were making sales all year round. What didn't matter, 30 degrees outside, minus 30, what didn't matter. We sell product that benefits you being in your house. Obviously, the pandemic was good for us. So we were skewed in thinking that this is the norm. And then come 2021, summer hits, people want to be outside. We're saying, well, look what it did last year. It should do the same this year, right? Because can't be. And then so we would act that way and we spent accordingly. And then you look back and you say, wait a second, I did achieve my sales and I achieved my growth, but I lost my margin, right? And I lost my profitability and I lost my product, right? Now I got to order more and shipping is more expensive and you end up losing in all these other areas. So, and that's the toughest thing I think in e-commerce as a whole or in any business as a whole is not being real with what is, with reality and chasing vanity metrics as opposed to coming back to what we're actually doing. We're running a business, right? And the business is a source of life, right? And if you strangle it and squeeze every last ounce out of it, you end up with something with a dried out business and customers that hate you and product that wasn't delivered on time. So just being real, it's tough.
Yeah. It's so tough, man, because we all want to go 500x each year. And it's just like that. Those things aren't possible, man. And we've learned so bad. That's such a good point, dude. How do you think about forecasting, right? So you're a young company. We're probably same, 4 or 5 years into business. Like, you have that COVID spike. So you think you're going to keep it up. You want to keep it up. You want to do everything you can. But how do you think about forecasting? For us, it was like, let's look at our DTC metrics, look at our retail metrics. And hey, maybe we do 50% that this year. And then we're measuring things on like a 3 or 4 month basis. How do you guys look at forecasting? Do you have somebody who handles that for you? What's that process look like?
Honestly, we're not the best at it. So it's tough. It's tough. Like, we've been in so many situations where, like, for example, last summer, we sell the world's coolest weighted blanket, right? It's just the only one that actually does the job. And since May 2021 until September, we had zero in stock. So for like, that's like you saying you've got no nets in the summer.
Yeah.
Only in the winter. And
nightmare.
It's an uphill battle, right? It's like, I can't even sell these. Like, it's harder for me to sell them right now as it is. And I don't even have them in stock, right? And because we had such a strong Q2 that we've never seen before, right? We had an incredible Q2. And unforeseen shipping delays and all these things. So now our mentality is do our best not to pay for the inventory. So whether it be securing loans or line of credits or dealing with getting better terms with our suppliers, we have incredible terms with our suppliers now. It's 10%. And then only after we receive it, it's installments of 10%, 10%. So it takes us like 6-7 months to pay for an order, which is amazing.
Amazing.
And, but that it, the negotiation, and anyone who's listening to this can take it, the negotiation is I'll order more. I'll house more inventory, right? Which is what I need to do anyways. So, and as entrepreneurs, we always sweat inventory because it's like money that's locked up. And even though on your balance sheet, it's dollar for dollar. So it doesn't ruin your actual economics. But entrepreneurs, the way we're wired is like, I got less money in my bank. I'm losing. Like, it's just so weird. And I think it's going to pass us at some point. Maybe at like the 10-year part, like when we get older and like, become more mature in business, but like there's still something that goes on in the head where it's like, oh my God, where's all the money? That's in inventory. Like, I don't know. That doesn't make me feel better. So now we're in a point where we're going to have excess inventory, or what we at least think will be excess, in hopes that we can actually run a full year for the first time ever without being out of stock, which will be cool. Cause I've never been a next day shipping kind of guy. I've never had the stock.
Yeah. Dude, that's so, yeah, we're in the same situation. We were trying to go 12 months in stock Australia just sold out last night, so we won't be hitting that. we won't be hitting that accomplishment. But in the United States, we're still in stock, thank God. What do you guys? So obviously, launching a company at scale through Facebook ads was the wave the last few years. It's obviously much harder now. Going back, what would you do differently to set yourself up for success right now? I know we are sadly a one trick pony with Facebook ads. We're doing a lot of great things elsewhere, but I wish we would have diversified our mix a lot earlier to prepare for this iOS like shitstorm. What have you guys done differently? What are you guys doing differently this year? I know you did a lot of out of home stuff last year. What's your thoughts there?
Yeah, I think that I don't actually think that anyone could have done anything differently. Like if you actually could have gone back, maybe would have tested a few more things, but there's nothing you would have actually done differently because the opportunity was on and still is actually on Facebook. It's just a different opportunity now. It's not scaled to the moon as best as possible all day long. It's just more difficult now and it just needs to be treated as one channel, right? Not the channel, yeah. Which it was for so many brands for so many years, because you literally gave a machine money and said, please find me customers, and it went and did it for you. It's like, I remember in 2017, I was at a conference with Gary Vee, and he ended like his whole mic drop, and he said, someone asked a question about drop shipping, I think it was, I forget, and like running it on Facebook, and he's like, I've never done drop shipping, but I will say one thing. He's like, there will be a point in time, this was 2017, where you realize that the opportunity you have right now might never come again for like another decade. And all of us didn't understand what that meant at the time until now. And he piggybacked that is earlier reminding everyone of what Google was when he was in the wine industry, paying 1 cent a click to rank number one on Google and build a $3 million to $30 million business on that. So there's all these different times in history where there's arbitrage. I personally think that arbitrage is going to now be TikTok. It's going to move there and will be very hard like Facebook was in 2012 to 2015, but eventually everyone and their mother will be a TikTok advertiser like they became Facebook advertisers, and will optimize and TikTok will get smarter and the AI will get smarter and the buyers will start buying and it will happen. But what we're doing now, that's what we're doing. We're just diversifying. We're spending elsewhere. The real question is, where is everybody scaling? And I think that is something that not everyone has the perfect, I mean, to a certain point, a certain point. Like, where are you scaling after a certain point? It's like, if you're not doing Facebook, okay, you can get it to a certain point. If you're not doing email, okay, you can get it to a certain point. But after you've checked all your boxes, then what? And that's where everyone's real answer is. I don't know. We're testing.
That's true. It's funny, man. Dude, think back a year ago, we didn't even know if TikTok was going to be on our phones anymore. TikTok was going to get banned from the United States, and I don't even know if it was banned in Canada, but think about how far that narrative has come from this thing is just a Chinese dancing app to now brands like ours are moving our money off Facebook onto TikTok and relying on that as being one of our acquisition channels. Like,
that's just wild. I saw my dad yesterday with my own eyes.
It blew
me away. Okay. He loves TikTok. Okay. But I'm always That's watching amazing. Him because he's like that. He's 65, right? He's always on TikTok. Yeah. And a year ago, he was on TikTok and it was just like girls dancing. He didn't really understand. He didn't love it so much. It's like really weird for him. Yeah. But now he's getting content that's like he loves, right? He loves like watching the news. He's literally watching news on TikTok. Okay. Loves watching news. And then I see him. Didn't even realize it was an ad for a shirt, for like a men's shirt. And he's like, oh, okay. And he clicks it and I see him on the site. He's like, oh, they don't have my size. And I'm like, whoa. You just went from a what? And he's never bought anything online before, but the platform is so interesting to him that he wanted to check it out. Mm-hmm. And when I saw that yesterday, you bet today we had a lot of internal meetings about TikTok because that is proof. And the phrase I've seen it on TikTok or, oh, I saw that on TikTok or where'd you get that from? Oh, like that happening is a huge step forward for TikTok. And once they figure out their ad platform, which I know they already are, I foresee a huge wave in budget reallocation from Facebook.
Absolutely. How, where are you guys getting like your inspiration from? Do you look at other brands in the sleepwear space and you kind of, I wouldn't say copy, that's a pretty shitty word, but like kind of get inspiration from them? Or is it, hey, we're heads down, we're hush, we're doing it our way, and we're thinking elsewhere. Like for us, for CrossNet, originally it was, hey, let's bash on the competition. Let's say why we're the best four-way volleyball net. And now that has left our vocabulary completely. Not even talking about other brands. It's just CrossNet and why we should be the best backyard game of all time. How do you guys think about it?
We've never went toe-to-toe with competition. We're premium. We're the most expensive. At the end of the day, if we try to win on features, sure, we'll have like, you know, a couple green checks and they'll be missing a couple and we'll have all these things and they won't. But then the customer just makes a decision on price and do I care about noise? Like, it's not about that, right? We're a brand. We're a community. We want people to be a part of our sleep mission. We want to get into a million people's beds. We have a huge give back program. We're constantly innovating. Like, you can actually be a part of something when it comes to Hush. So it's, when it comes to brands like in our space, we're watching because I love seeing brands in our space don't do what we do. They're not on social. They're not running the type of ads that we're running. They're not being as aggressive. They don't have faces. They don't have founders that are out there. They're simply well-oiled machines that have been around for a long time. And in most cases, they're not profitable. There's very few profitable sleep brands out there, which is why they always roll up to the next one. They just keep rolling up. But the ones that are profitable, they're beautiful machines, but they're very different than us, right? They sell either a really good product for really cheap, or they sell a unique product. In most cases, in bedding, it's very difficult to be 100% unique because it's textiles are tough to patent. For us, it's really just kind of looking what's going on and then seeing if it's inspiring at all. I think in my space, a lot of people really put a ton of time in their website. They have like the most beautiful websites. Everything is aesthetic. And like, so we do draw inspiration from there, but from like advertising and stuff like that, like I know people in my space only doing direct mail and making a killing. So it's, everyone's got their own little niche.
So last question I got for you, because it's every entrepreneur's dream to get acquired one day, right? Like you make your beautiful business, you sell it eventually, you get rich, you retire. I know you guys have recently had a partial acquisition, right? Like talk to me about that. I know we've talked a lot about it offline, but for the listeners, right? You're starting your company today or you're 4 years in, you want to sell it. Like what has that process been like? Share as much as you're comfortable about like, what's the process been like with working with them? Why were they a great partner? What were you looking for? Where it kind of made you have those giddy feelings that we were talking about offline.
Yeah, the giddies. For us, it was very natural. We didn't want to sell anything particularly in the when it happened, but we built a relationship with Sleep Country, which is Canada, one of Canada's largest retailers, the largest in the bedding space. And they were just such an incredible group of people. Like the president and now the CEO, Stu, is like almost like a father figure to us. Like he was just so open and really like for us, it was an opportunity to learn and to like be a part of something special. Like I've only ever started startups, right? Like 50 people, organizations, perhaps. Like they've got 1,600 people and 400 locations and thousands of SKUs, and they start their website and their website's already a massive business, and they've built, it's just everything is done to such a high level. And for us, it's like I'm never gonna get a like corporate job, I don't think. It's like I'll never be a part of something like that unless like this is the only way I'd ever like be exposed to like something so beautiful. And the team and they really liked us and we really liked them, so it was kind of just coming up with a deal that worked for both of us. It was like a year and a half since we spoke to when we closed. And like now we're a few months post acquisition and dealing with them is cool. I mean, you get access to a suite of things. Like we house all of our own inventory. We've never used 3PLs. Moving forward, we'll just merge into their 30 distribution centers. We're already working on a new mattress, like something crazy. They have a whole R&D team for that. Like we're developing a new pillow out of like soy and charcoal dough, and their whole R&D team is like fired up to help us with it. So like you get access to big corporate tools, but we still get to be small and nimble. So for us, it was really about the relationship. If it wasn't, then I would probably just sell 100% of the business. I wouldn't, if I didn't like them, then I wouldn't have done a deal or become partners. So it's always nice to take chips off the table, specifically when you're younger and you're still, you know, building it up. And for us, it was an opportunity to take a little bit of chips off the table, but still be involved for years to come, a minimum of 3 years. So, and because we still believe in Hush. So it's all to each their own, but it's really about, in every deal, you're still handing over the keys to your baby, to something you've worked on, something that you spent half a decade of my life building, right? With every ounce and every entrepreneur knows. It's all day, all night. It's all you think about. It's, you wake up in the morning, at night, it's like all day long. And the last thing I would ever do is hand the keys to some private equity firm that was just going to probably run it to the ground in a few years. And everyone will ask me, what happened with that thing? And I'm like, I don't even want to talk about it, you know? So this was a win-win situation where we felt happy to be a part of such a big company and be able to still lead the ship for the next few years.
So happy for you, man. That's amazing, dude. Yeah. I'm so, so happy. Thanks for coming on, dude. If anybody out there listening needs a new mattress, new blanket, new pillows, like, posh, legit. I sleep with it every night. You're in my bed. So, Aaron, there you go. Thanks for joining, man. I appreciate it. We'll talk soon.
Thank you.
So that's another episode of My Biggest Lessons. Each and every week, I'll be having one of my favorite entrepreneurs come on, share their stories, their mistakes, the things they wish they knew. Entrepreneurship's a lonely road, right? You only learn by getting better. You only learn by making mistakes. So I want them to come on and share their stories. If you have somebody in mind that you want on, drop a comment, subscribe, share with a friend. Let's get the best people in the world on here. Thanks for listening.